Welcome to Rails with Jason. I'm Jason Sweat. A quick word before today's episode. If you're a Rails developer, there's a good chance you're writing tests. If you want to get better at writing tests, or if you're not currently writing tests and you want to learn how, go to codewithjason.com where you can find my free Ruby testing micro course. Now on to the episode. Welcome to Rails with Jason. I'm your host, Jason Sweat. My guest today is Frank Rieta. Frank is the founder and web application security architect at Rieta Incorporated. Frank, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Frank, do you want to tell listeners about yourself a little?
Sure. So as you said, I'm Frank, and I have been in the internet web application business since before we called them web applications. In the mid-90s, I got into programming as a teenager, and I just fell in love. I actually started a web hosting business before I went to college. It was called Atlanta Web Host. And so that was part of during the dot-com boom when if you were a teenager living with your parents and had a website, you could still get business with the likes of a Cox Business Services or a Sprint because they were having websites built out so quickly, and no one knew that you were just a kid. It's a lot harder now. And so that's when I first really got into web development with PHP 3 and MySQL 3 and all that old stuff. But then my parents said, you have to go to college. So I said, okay. And so I studied computer science, and then I got really interested in security, so I ended up doing a master's degree in information security about 2007 is when I graduated. And at the time, I became pretty discouraged that most of the job opportunities seemed to be around network security or, you know, go work for Microsoft or all these fabulous or the government, all these fabulous opportunities. But no one that I knew was really taking what we were learning in the graduate program and applying it to web development, to web application security. And about the same time, I had read a book with Gary McGraw wrote on software security, building it in. And that just really reinforced that at the time that there is no security that can be added on at the end. And we had this massive gap where people were making websites and soon to be APIs for mobile applications with not nearly enough security as part of the process. So that's the short version of, so I started a business because I clearly couldn't just go get a job. So that's how that early stage happened.
Okay. And yeah, I like the thing you mentioned about adding security on at the end. It's like, okay, we're almost done. Just now make it secure.
Right. So we're ready to ship. Can we get the pen testers in here? And it's like, you want it to ship like tomorrow? What's this?
Hey, have you ever witnessed that kind of an approach?
Yes, and it doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah, I always find that funny in like the Gantt chart style waterfall kind of project management where it's like, they do testing at the end. They allocate some time for testing at the very end, but they don't allocate any time to address any of the issues that might have been discovered in that testing period, which is obviously just insane because what are you going to do? You're just assuming that everything's going to be okay.
Right, because of course it has to be. And I mean, that's not just a security problem. That happens in a lot of places. I mean, that's why we do iterative development. I mean, that's why Agile has won in so many circles, because we should be doing that testing as we go, right? So, and that does seem much more prevalent than it used to be.
Yeah, which is good. So, Frank, you supplied me with a list of questions to ask you, and I'm going to kind of jump around randomly in your questions.
Perfect. Bring it. And anything else, too.
Nice. So, my first question, it's one of your questions, but it's the one that most interests me for starters, is what is application security? And I assume, like, just to contextualize this question, we mean what is application security as opposed to, like, some other kind of IT security. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So a definition I've given in presentations is that application security is part of information security. So that was that broader discipline. Sometimes you hear the term cybersecurity. Oftentimes, that's a holistic thing. How do we do a defense in depth? You know, we talk about network security, organizational processes, all sorts of things. But application security is a subset and is focused on protecting data and privacy from abuse by adversaries who have access to the software system as a whole. And what I mean by that is that we have to make the software itself more resilient to attack, because there's no firewall that will protect us. So on the web, we have port 443. And so anyone in the world can reach out and connect to our web service. And so there's no firewall that can block that off and keep all the bad traffic over here at bay and only let in the good traffic. The application itself is making all meaningful security decisions. And therefore, the application itself must be the source of software security.
Okay. And are there any things, any parts of security that you see web developers being commonly ignorant of? Or to kind of phrase that question in a different way, are there any, like, if you had to pick, like, the top handful of security principles that developers should know, what would some of those be?
Absolutely. So one of the best resources, and it's free, it's out there, it's not made by any company that's trying to sell anything, is the OWASP Top 10. This stands for the Open Web Application Security Project, which OWASP stands for. And the top 10 is a list that's been updated over the last little bit more than a decade. I think, don't hold me to this, I think it was first in 2003. It was around that time, that year. And the funny thing about it is that the mistakes have been remarkably common and consistent, even though some of the names have changed. So the top ones for absolute certain, and it's still to this day, SQL injection vulnerabilities, cross-site scripting, trusting user-supplied content and otherwise. So you take a string from your params hash in Rails, you jam it into the order by clause or a pluck in your active record, and next thing you know, your functionality works as your test worked, but now someone can use a SQL injection to cause real damage, to either steal data from your database or destroy data. Basically, any way they can manipulate the SQL interpreter, because the SQL itself is an interpreter, and SQL injection allows a malicious player to go through the functionality that you meant to be there in ways you didn't think of and abuse your system. Another one is cross-site scripting. By default in Rails.
Sorry to interrupt, but you know, it would be neat. Maybe even I have the list up here on my computer. It might even be neat if we could just real quick go through all 10 and just touch on them.
Sure. Let me pull up that list for myself right here, so I'm not just winging it.
Yeah. So this first one in the list I'm looking at, the number one just says injection as opposed to SQL injection specifically. Right. I think that's, you know, that's a pretty commonly known vulnerability type or whatever. That's not the right term, but you know, most developers seem to know about SQL injection and how to protect against it. Luckily, Rails kind of gives us the tools to.
It really does. It makes a huge difference.
Yeah. So that one I think is like pretty well covered. And I don't know if you and I are looking at the same list, but the second one on mine is broken authentication and session management. Is number two something like that for you also?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm pulled it up here. Okay, so this is the OWASP Top 10 2017, which was the most recent one. And so, yeah, we can look at this from a couple different directions. So broken authentication, in a Rails context, a lot of times people use frameworks like Devise, and that gives you a pretty decent package of user sign-in. When I've come in as an auditor, people do tend to use Devise, and that really puts them off, sets them off on a good course. However, there's a lot more to authentication and access control than just Devise. So if you think, oh, I throw in authentication and I don't do authorization, then you've only had part of the puzzle. Or if there's fundamental flaws with your authorization logic, you can end up what used to be called a direct object reference. I believe they've moved it.
Sorry, just to kind of back up, what's the difference between authentication and authorization?
Sure, absolutely. So authentication is, my name is Frank, and that's identification. And then I'm going to prove it to you. I'm going to enter a password. I'm going to use my two-factor key. And now the authorization, I have authorized myself. I'm stammering over it. I have authenticated myself as really me. I have proven my bona fides as me. Authorization is the second step, which is now as me, as Frank, I'm asking the server, hey, can you show me this record? And it says, sure, no problem, and hands it over. Well, one of the things when that's done poorly or there's a problem, so I'm logged in, and because I'm logged in, I can access, in extreme case, any record. So maybe there's a hidden field that says an account ID, or maybe it's in the URL because we're practicing REST. And unless you have a can or a pundit or an authorization layer saying that yes, this is Frank and Frank can access this record, then you can have a major problem. And that does happen quite a bit, and it's usually not the case that someone doesn't know it, that it needs to be done at all, but mistakes are made, and that's an area where a lot of problems can happen really fast.
Yep, I agree, especially the authorization part. It's not always a super easy part to get right.
No, there's a lot of problems. And it can also be a source of a lot of slowness if you put together your depending on the tool you're using. I'm thinking abilities in the case of can. Pundit tends to call them policies. But that can cause a lot of inefficient SQL, and then you try to optimize around that, and then your optimization adds a security vulnerability where maybe the slow version didn't. And so it's a tricky area.
So just to continue to go down the list here, number three is sensitive data exposure. And I think people are kind of familiar with, of course, what that means, but do you have any commentary to add to that one?
Yeah, so let's say you're building a Rails. So there's two ways you see this quite often. One that keeps on hitting the headlines is people leaving their S3 buckets unprotected. Mm-hmm. And so you have a file that's uploaded, and it's at a very predictable path. So maybe it's like /attachment/IDE/something.pdf. And so because there's no actual, if the bucket is left public, then anyone can get at it. This is a massive problem. It can happen with PII being exposed in Georgia.
PII being years ago. Personally identifiable information?
Yes, sir. And sometimes PII also is protected, like patient data, or if you're under jurisdiction for GDPR, you could have, you know, other protected private data that there's legal consequences to not protecting. A couple years ago, in the state of Georgia where I live, there was a situation where a web server was misconfigured, and it left private voter data, like public on the internet, like for Google to index and anyone to find.
Oh, no.
It became a big deal. So this isn't just, you know, just for our, it's a common problem.
Wow.
Related to that would be, like developer secrets being left in GitHub. It's not as bad as it used to be. People used to add their AWS keys to the repo, and then it was exposed. And next thing you know, they had like $60,000 bill. You know, GitHub started scanning for that stuff, but it still happens all the time. I can't go into details, but I am aware, based on someone familiar with the matter, that there may be a data breach hitting the news that was related, where server credentials that shouldn't have been in GitHub ended up in a public GitHub repo because some developer did something. So,
oh no!
So it can happen.
Yeah, it's not an academic concern. These things really do occur.
Yes, they do.
So going to number four on the list, this is actually one I have no idea what it is, so I'm glad you're here. XML external entities. What the heck is that all about?
Let me read this real quick. This is not one I think about every day. So the description they use, I'm going to go off the description here. Mm-hmm. So many older or poorly configured XML processors evaluate external entity references within XML documents. External entities can be used to disclose internal files. Okay, so this is like almost like an eval in Ruby. So by the way, you're basically a Rails application. You should just basically consider eval to be not allowed anywhere in your code base. Like, there's always a better way. We'll get to that. But that's what I read this as. It is a way in some frameworks. I don't think this is common with Rails to inject malicious code and have it do something for you, that for you being the attacker inside of the target server.
Okay. And then number five. And so,
mm-hmm. Okay. In the eval case, actually, we could talk about this. This is very related to dangerous evals, which is an error Brakeman will rise. And that is, if you can inject content into the params hash or into a cookie that is somehow makes it into an eval statement, then you can execute arbitrary Ruby code or and do any like really terrible things on the server. And actually, that was used recently in a malicious gem where it was Bootstrap SAS. Some attackers managed to get hold of the legitimate publisher's Ruby gems password and publish a malicious version that was intentionally designed so that they could use eval to execute arbitrary code on their target servers. And it got downloaded a ton of times.
Oh, wow.
Before it got called.
I was aware of that incident, but I wasn't really familiar with the details of what happened. But that sounds pretty bad.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah. I checked my application for Bootstrap SAS after that, and luckily I happened not to use that one.
Yep. If we want to talk about it more later, that's called a supply chain attack, and the that situation is really a wake-up call that this is a real issue and we don't have any systematic protection within the Ruby Gems ecosystem.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that sounds like a good thing to address. Okay, so going down the list, some more. Number five, broken access control. If I didn't know better, which I don't really know better, this sounds very similar to number two, broken authentication. I don't know how this one is different.
So we kind of combined these two when I was talking about authentication and authorization. So,
oh, yeah. So access control, are they talking about authorization in that
case?
Are. So number two was kind of like the authentication one, and number five is the authorization.
Yeah, version. We kind of smushed those together when we're talking about it.
Okay.
They really are two sides of a coin. So.
Yeah, very related. And then number six seems incredibly broad, security misconfiguration.
Yes, all the ways you can be wrong.
I imagine there's like four ways or so, right?
At least, right?
Yeah, that's a joke. There's probably like 400,000 ways.
Bad passwords, not turning on two-factor on your cloud services account, which, by the way, can be disastrous. I'll throw one out for you. So you're humming along, and your business is growing, and you got like the sophisticated IT team running everything, but the company domain is still hosted on the founder's GoDaddy account with the password Hunter 2.
Okay.
And so if this happens, and I don't, the name is escaping me at the moment, but there was actually an attack against a bank where an attacker was able to man in the middle ATM machines by using the domain registrar to control the DNS to inject themselves in the middle and get a let's encrypt SSL cert, and then we're able to intercept traffic to and from like the bank's like ATM network.
Okay, I have to ask, hackers, who are these people? Because I've always wondered this, because like these are like very smart, capable people who also have no like moral compass or something like that, apparently. And they just they're evidently motivated by money or something. Do you have insight into who the heck these people are?
All of the above. So there are hackers who are in it for their own purposes. They just, you know, money, fame, that sort of thing. Their nation states are heavily involved in espionage and cyber warfare, both the defense and the doing cyber warfare. So, for example, the hack on Sony, I believe it is no secret that it is attributed to North Korea. So as actual nation state attack against a private company. So it's a broad question. And then just straight up cybercrime, there's a lot of money in it. So there's plenty of people that are just straight up in it for the money. You know, maybe part of organized crime or in Eastern Europe or Russia. I mean, you know, cyber criminals come from all sorts of places. And some of them really are in it for the money. Or they're in it because they are part of the defense apparatus of a country that is conducting offensive operations, or they're in it just, you know, so there's a lot of different motivations, but the vulnerabilities are the same. And one of the kind of the, where that breaks down is your adversaries are, so you know, most of us are like, you know, we want to make a website, we want to make a business, you know, we want to do something. And we live in this world where in the physical realm, we have, you know, you could probably leave your door unlocked most nights, right? And no one's going to try it because, you know, most of us live in a reasonable area and, you know, there are police, and then we're not really afraid that some foreign government agency is going to like steal from us because, you know, there's borders and militaries and there's a lot of layers of defense in society. We have a defense in depth. But on the internet, there's really no borders. So you're just really sitting there, and literally any adversary in the world can check to see if your door just is open. And if it is, can use that to their advantage and to your disadvantage. So we really are, in a lot of senses, on our own. And that's one reason cybersecurity is such a challenge. From both for us as practitioners who have to effectively build Fort Knox, like everyone has to have Fort Knox, because we are all adrift on the sea of the internet without any governmental protections around us, really.
Yeah, wow. I think people don't think about that side of the coin all that much. It's like, You hear people say things like how great it is that you can publish a blog post and then it's accessible to the whole entire world, but also that blog post is accessible to the whole entire world, and anybody who wants to can try to attack your website. They're not constrained by geography like they are in the physical world.
Yep. And so now I'll take it one further. So you have this awesome app. You're like, we have the best mobile app ever. We're going to be famous. So we get that in the app store. We've spent tons and tons of time making our mobile app and work on the iOS, on the Android. We're going to town. And we threw together the web service that it talks to at the last minute. And because we control the mobile app, we get lured into the false sense of, well, if our mobile app doesn't do it, then there's no problem. That's all it's ever going to do. And you can end up, a lot of these things we talk about, like in web applications, you see a lot of old vulnerabilities in the mobile API servers because, you know, it's just the Wild West. And if their mobile app doesn't do it, they don't think that to defend against it. But that api.ourawesomecompany.com is publicly accessible to everyone in the world, including anyone who wants to go after you and see what vulnerabilities there may be. And if you don't have proper access control and someone hits like /users, if you just use the Rails generators, I've seen it where it actually dumped the like email addresses and password hashes of all the users in the system, because, you know, that's just how it worked, because no one would know about that URL.
Okay, so I don't want to say ensure, because I don't think you can really ensure anything. You can only make it less likely. But how do you decrease the chances? How do you give yourself a reasonable degree of confidence that you don't have stuff like that available?
Keep it super simple. And what I mean by that is, earlier I mentioned the tool break. So there are tool, if you're doing Ruby on Rails, there's two tools you should always run.
Okay.
They're not going to protect you completely. You should always be running Brakeman, and you should always be running Bundler Audit. Brakeman's going to tell you if you've made some super common coding mistake that could have a security implication. It's not going to catch everything, but it catches a lot. Bundler Audit is going to tell you this gem's out of date and has a known security thing. You better patch it. The third step is audit your routes. So run rake routes and be sure that every single route that is there for a specific purpose that is part of the design. And any of the index actions that might be used to dump, be sure that you audit them manually to make sure that you have decent access control, or it's not returning data. Like that would be like in broad strokes how to have some level of assurance. If you want to go further and you want to audit yourself as you go, and when I'm hired to do security audits, another OWASP tool that I use is called the ASVS. It's the Application Security Verification Standard. And this document has a lot of questions and common patterns of attack organized. And so you can follow that. And it has L1, L2, and L3. So L1 would be kind of like, this matters for all apps. L3 would be, this matters if, you know, there's money and lives on the line, like a higher level of certainty. So go through that and use that as a guide as you do your code reviews to make sure that nothing has slipped through the cracks of your plan, your consciousness on that.
That was going to be one of my next questions is having like some kind of external audit done, because it seems like you have like a conflict of interest almost. If you're looking at your own code, you want it to be secure, because if you look at your app and it's secure enough, then you don't have to do any extra work. So you have like an incentive to find that to be the case. But an outside person doesn't have that incentive, and so that's probably going to be a more effective audit.
I mean, they both have their place, right? So if you can avoid the problem in the first place, then if I'm code reviewing your code, I'm not pinging you on all this little like entry-level stuff, but you know, we get to actually go deeper. Whereas if, you know, you've just been flying fast and loose and not caring about security, not only do you have real problems, but you know, you're not getting as much out of when you start engaging those more expensive, like third-party code review audit stuff.
So I just took us on an extremely long tangent, which pre-show I warned you was a distinct possibility.
You want to hit up the last of the top 10?
Yeah. Let's just hit these last four. We'll go through them pretty quick, I guess. Cross-site scripting. Now,
yeah, buddy.
I think this is something that I haven't even like thought about in so long. If somebody asked me like, quick, Jason, what's cross-site scripting? I don't think I'd be able to tell you. So what's that all about?
So cross-site scripting is a vulnerability where someone can manipulate the web application to deliver malicious code to another user of the web application. So, for example, you have rich text that you allow to be entered, and then you render it in such a way that it shows up as rich text on a web page. You have just some way to get content that you didn't intend in there. And if that can include malicious code like JavaScript, or could link to something like an SVG image, which could contain malicious code, then you could use that to do something annoying, like show ads or something, or do something really targeted, like take over someone's webcam. Or a real danger for cross-site scripting is if the public side, if there's a public side and a customer service side. So a really crafty attack will take, put a payload as a user intended to be executed by a staff member who has privileges to access more records. So if I can get someone, a customer service browser, which is logged into the customer service portal, which has access to every customer's data, to execute JavaScript that allows them me to then get them to exfiltrate data out or to steal their session, unencrypted session cookie, so that I can assume their session, then I can do absolute severe disastrous damage.
Oh, wow.
So it can be weaponized. But the base of it is, anytime you put user supplied content that gets executed as code, that can be cross-site scripting.
That reminds me of an occasion in the 90s when I was a kid. I was in some kind of chat room, and there was absolutely no sanitization of the input. So you could put HTML tags, whatever, and it would just happily accept it and render it on the page. It was great. Great for me, not great for the website.
And I actually have a point I'll add here in Rails. There's a very dangerous command called .htmlsafe. You basically should never use it. Very few times you should. And you should pretty much always use the sanitize helper, which uses loofah, which actually will load the HTML and sanitize it. And it uses, I think, Nokugiri. So it's not fooled by, like, just regex in a way that a regex could be fooled.
Oh, wow. I was not aware of that one. I'm definitely using HTML safe in an application I'm working on right now.
Yeah. If that's coming from a user supplied input, that might as well be called, hey, look, hold my beer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's bad.
Luckily, it's not.
Good. So maybe it has its place, but yeah, that
something
would be
to know. That's something an area to be aware of. Yeah. Okay. Number 8, insecure deserialization. I do not know what that is.
Let me read this real quick.
Serialization is used to turn an object into data that can be sent somewhere or stored. And then there's a whole paragraph of stuff.
Yep. So in Rails, this is like constantize. So if you have a string and you want to turn it into a class name, you can call .constantize on it. But that's very unsafe because you can end up injecting, like, you can go from user input to executable Ruby code, like in your process. So that there's a whole class of vulnerabilities around this. So in general, that's what it's talking about, but it's being generic about it that applies to many programming platforms and systems and things.
Okay. And we'll speed right through 9 and 10 here. 9 almost seems like common sense. I guess to an extent a lot of these are, but 9 is using components with known vulnerabilities.
Yeah, if your bundler audit says that you're on a version of Rails that has bad known security vulnerabilities and you keep on using that because you have so many gems that you can't upgrade because, you know, something's broken and you're like, we don't have the time and money to fix this, then you have a known vulnerability component and you're not fixing it. And that gets you in a bad place.
Yeah, that one's very straightforward to understand. Number 10, insufficient logging and monitoring.
Yep.
Okay.
So, I'm going to try to tie this to something that your develop. I mean, obviously, like, log all the things, right? Like, know what regulatory regime your business works in. So you might work in a place that has to keep, you know, destroy all records after 90 days, or you might be in a place where you have to keep certain records for 7 years because it supports audit. So you can't audit what's not logged. One of the areas that this happens a lot is, let's say you build an application, and I'm not just talking about like your Rails logs or your paper trail or whatever you do. Let's say that you don't sufficiently log administrative activity to your application. So you can't tell that, the biggest risk is an insider threat. And so a common mistake is you find out that you suspect someone on staff may have been abusing their access to look at customer records they shouldn't have, or have to have stolen data or just something. And if you didn't specifically build in functionality to log that, you know, administrative user 3 accessed this record and then accessed this record at this time, then you don't have any evidence. You don't have any logs to investigate. And so that's an example of insufficient logging and monitoring. Just one. I mean, there's plenty of them, but.
Okay. Well, we're nearing time for the episode, but luckily I think we've covered everything to do with security, right? That's all that anybody needs to know.
Oh, definitely not. This just scratching the surface. But honestly, I think every developer needs to be aware of the OWASP top 10. And if you take the lessons from this, because these are still the main ways that applications are compromised, and the list, though it has changed slightly, has been remarkably stable for the last decade. So we're making the same mistakes that we've been making for a long time.
Sounds not necessarily unique to security.
No, it's not.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there are a lot more questions that I want to ask you, but we don't have time for all that, unfortunately. A couple of things that I do want to still ask you before we go are, first, can you tell me just a little bit about Rieta? Like, what kind of services do you perform for your clients? It sounds like auditing is something that you do. And, like, are you specific to Rails? Do you work mostly with Rails? Tell me about that.
Okay, so as a company, we do work mostly with Rails. I have done security work where it was organizational. They have their own development teams. You know, they have products in retail stores all over the country. And so in that case, it's not Rails, right? It's general. So that sort of security is generic. We really have two lines of services. One is hardened feature development. So we actually do, when we say you can't bolt security on at the end, it has to be part of your development process. Some of our clients come to us and say, well, we really want to be secure and we need an app that works. And so we actually do development, like to build hardened features. And a lot of that work has been in Rails. We are looking at other platforms for the long term. I think a lot of our team is really into Phoenix and Elm and some future technologies. But for our clients, it's mostly Ruby on Rails. We pick up support. So sometimes organizations will have had a Rails application built in the past, and the development team is no longer part of the picture. And they find out that all of a sudden, maybe their Google API stopped working, or they're aware that, hey, we're required to patch for security and we don't have anyone to patch for security. And so we end up doing kind of maintenance work too on older applications. So we end up adopting code bases that other people created. And then the fun part for me is the security code reviews. Instead of doing penetration testing where I try to break in from the outside, I try to do the open book code review approach of talk with the business to understand the risks that they're facing, talk with the developers to understand what they built, and then work, you know, open book with the source code. I'm looking for things like these OWASP top 10 issues and then digging deeper too. And the ASVS, the OWASP ASVS is a tool that I use for that. It's free and open to everyone, and so it's a good tool to have. So that is Rieta Nutshell. We are a primarily a web application security firm, but to do that, you have to do both the review work, and we do enjoy build work, though we do work with clients that have their own build teams.
So last question, and I know part of the answer to this question because it's embroidered on your shirt, but yes. where can people go to learn more about you and about Rieta Incorporated?
Absolutely. Rietta.com. Rietta.com.
And that was the embroidery.
Yes, it is. And I've had this domain a long time. So it is fun. It also means that I have my email. They can actually email me at frank@rietta.com.
All right.
So my first at my last name is the best.
Yeah, that's a nice... I don't have jason@sweat.com. I don't even know. I believe I've checked sweat.com, and it's I don't own it. There's also there's jasonsweat.net and jasonsweat.com. Mm-hmm. I'm jasonsweat.net, but there's some other guy at jasonsweat.com. He does computer stuff. He's like a programmer. Yeah, it's infuriating. So I'm going to go track that guy down and take over his website. Maybe you can help me take over his website. Put on your black hat.
That doesn't sound very ethical.
I didn't say it was ethical.
Oh, okay. And then there's, if I may inject this towards the end, if it's all right.
Yeah.
If you're doing Rails, run Brakeman. You know, these are good tools. Just add them to your process. And then if you search my blog for software abuser stories, I have an entire article where I talk about writing user stories from the point of view of a malicious adversary, and that can really change how you approach your software requirements and add security into your requirements, your TDD, and your development. And that really starts to move the needle.
Yeah, that sounds like a really interesting approach. And while you were saying that, I went to jasonsweat.com. Yep. And all that comes up is it just says page okay. It's just a blank white page that says page okay. So maybe this is up for sale. I'll go investigate this after.
Make him a deal. Maybe he's ready to cash out and maybe not for that much.
I'll give you $100.
Hey, someone might take that.
Yeah. Hey, if somebody offered me $100 for some of my domains I've collected over the years, I'd unload it for that.
Absolutely. I actually at one point owned requirementsgathering.com, but I let it slip. Yeah.
I bought angularcli.com thinking that maybe Google would come knocking on my door someday. They never did.
Yeah.
Mm. It seems like every developer has this domain collecting hobby, and it's probably among the hobbies that have the worst ROI of most hobbies.
Oh, it's horrible. I just burn a few $100 a month in domains that I'll probably never use for anything. Or not a month, a year.
And then a year rolls by and it's like, attention, blah, blah, blah is expiring. And you get to be reminded.
Oh, no, I don't want to give it up.
Well, for me, I get to be reminded about my bad choice I made a year ago. I bought that?
Yeah.
Okay, so this seems like a good and appropriate place to end the episode. So thanks so much for coming on the show. Despite my tangents inside the episode and here at the end, there were actually some really good takeaways. The Brakeman and the Bundler audit tools, yes. Those seem like good actionable takeaways for the listener. So Frank, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jason, for having me. I really enjoyed it.